In federal prisons today, inmates the government has labeled eco-terrorists are incarcerated alongside international terrorists who were convicted after 9/11. The so-called eco-terrorists were sentenced for committing crimes like conspiracy and arson as part of a movement to economically hurt businesses they believe are harming the environment. One of those activists is Daniel McGowan, who is serving a 7-year sentence for his role in two arsons set in Oregon in 2001, and he's at the center of a new documentary called If a Tree Falls, a story of the Earth Liberation Front. It's co-directed by Marshall Curry and Sam Coleman and opens today at the IFC Center in Greenwich Village on 6th Avenue. I'm very pleased to welcome Marshall Curry to our show today. Hello.
Thank you for having me.
Didn't Daniel McGowan happen to work for your wife? It must have come as quite a shock when he was arrested in her office.
It was a shock. She runs a domestic violence organization in Brooklyn and came home from work one day and said, "You'll never guess what happened." 4 federal agents walked in and arrested that guy, Daniel McGowan.
Were you surprised? Was he the kind of person you or your wife would have associated with eco-terrorism?
No, not at all.
He didn't talk about those things?
No, well, he was an environmentalist for sure. And I remember having a couple of arguments with him about whether you should vote. And he sort of thought that voting was buying into the political process too much. And so I would say he clearly was on the radical edge to some extent, but he doesn't really look like a terrorist. He doesn't talk like a terrorist.
Well, but he could do some funny things. In the film, his sister shares a story about Daniel recycling labels from her cans and jars, which seems to speak to one aspect of his character.
Yeah, it's kind of a funny story. She says that at a point when he was just out of college, he was so excited about recycling that he took the labels off of all of the cans in her cupboard, but without indicating what was inside of them. And in some ways, that story says a lot about his passion and maybe not thinking through the ramifications of every decision he was making.
Do you think that he's typical of Earth Liberation Front or ELF members? That you met over the course of the filming?
In some ways, there is no typical Earth Liberation Front. I mean, he grew up in Rockaway, Queens. His dad's a New York cop. He was a business major in college. There were also people who were part of his case who were kind of, anarchist dumpster diving kids who lived in squat houses and sold pot. And there were one woman who was an executive at Microsoft and went yacht racing on the weekends after doing these arsons. So it's a really wide range of people. But in some ways, there were some similarities, and that's what the movie kind of tries to trace. Is a lot of these folks started out letter writing and petition gathering, and then got involved in civil disobedience, and then got involved in sort of small scale property destruction, and ultimately these multi-million-dollar arsons.
When did the ELF? When was it formed?
Well, in sort of the mid to late 90s, a guy named Jake Ferguson, who is a character in our film, did the very first ELF fire. And he burned a ranger station in Oregon to sort of attack the way that the Forest Service works with the timber industry.
And that's what that's their goal, to change government policy?
Well, I think there are a couple. There's sort of a theoretical goal, like an intellectual goal, and their spokesman will explain that the goal is to cause economic damage to businesses in the hopes that it will make those businesses make different decisions. And also, there's a symbolic significance that they sort of see it as the Boston Tea Party to try to attract attention to these things.
And they join other anarchist activities. Didn't they participate in the Black Bloc at the 1999 WTO protests?
That's right. And that's where Daniel kind of got one of his first tastes of property destruction, breaking windows and things like that there.
They circulate manuals on monkey wrenching, and they communicate in code, which would suggest that they want to remain rather shadowy. What is monkey wrenching?
Well, monkey wrenching, depending on whose side you are, some people would call that a euphemism, and other people would say that it's a not. But it is kind of small scale property destruction, putting sugar in the gas tank of bulldozers, or pulling up survey stakes, or cutting gluing locks of things.
And Oregon seems to be a popular site for much of the ELF's activities. Why Oregon?
Well, particularly in those years, it was kind of ground zero for a lot of the environmental movement.
Because of logging?
A lot of it was logging. You know, there were a lot of old growth forests that were being cut, trees 500 years or 1,000 years old being cut to make timber. There were battles over, you know, horse slaughterhouses that were out there. Because there's so much public land and because people have kind of a passionate connection to that land, I think that's probably the reason.
But you can see people being radicalized by some of the things, not to the point of some of their activities. For example, you cover in the film businesses cutting down old growth trees to make way for a parking lot. Now, yep. Joni Mitchell wrote a song about it.
Yeah, so those people probably wouldn't necessarily describe those as old growth. I think most people would think old growth is hundreds of years, but these were heritage trees, beautiful old trees. And when they tried to protest that by climbing up the trees, the police rolled in with cherry pickers and tear gassed the folks in the trees and pepper sprayed them and that reaction to nonviolent civil disobedience, I think, for a lot of folks, made them decide that that was ineffective and they needed to ratchet it up.
And you include some pretty disturbing videos involving protesters and the police.
Right. Yeah. Particularly in those years, there was a lot of use of pepper spray against nonviolent activists. And
it goes further. They hit them. There's a certain amount of police brutality.
Right.
So they see the police as defenders of the status quo?
Definitely.
Of the big businesses?
That's exactly right.
Why do you think the police deal with these protesters so aggressively?
I spend a lot of time – the film focuses on Daniel McGowan, but we spend a lot of time with the arson victims and the police officers and the prosecutor on the case who put them in prison. And I think there was a very significant cultural divide between protesters and police.
And tell me about the arsons.
Well, there were a number of arsons that the Earth Liberation Front took part, participated in. Forest Service buildings, horse slaughterhouses, timber companies. The two that Daniel participated in, one was the offices of a timber company, and the other one was a tree farm that was growing what they thought. Incorrectly, they thought were growing genetically engineered trees that they feared would kind of get out into the wild and mess up the natural ecosystem.
But then Daniel McGowan distanced himself from the ELF after the arsons.
That's right.
He had a change of heart?
I think a combination of things happened. That the fire that he took part in of the tree farm, they found out that the tree farm was not actually doing what they thought they were doing. And the same night, another group associated with his group lit a huge fire at the University of Washington. What they hoped was going to be a small fire, but got out of control, as arsons often do. I think after seeing those two fires, he had a sense that this is much more dangerous and much less productive. Suddenly, everybody's talking about catching the arsons, not talking about the issues that they were trying to draw attention to.
My guest is Marshall Curry, co-director with Sam Coleman, of a film called If a Tree Falls, A Story of the Earth Liberation Front, which opens today at the IFC Center on 6th Avenue in Greenwich Village. At one point in the film, McGowan says that no real social change happens without force. Do you think he still believes that?
I think he believes, yes, that nothing happens without force. How you might define that force, I think, is maybe one of the questions. So,
but he doesn't want to burn down things anymore.
I don't think he wants to burn things down anymore, no.
And it took many years for him and the other participants in the arsons to be identified and arrested. How had they escaped for so long?
Well, they were really careful. I mean, as the detective on the case says, that they were really good at what they did. They were careful about DNA, making sure there was no DNA. They built, these carefully constructed timing devices and were very careful about covering their tracks. And so for years they went without the government having any idea who had done it.
How did the government finally figure out who was responsible for the arsons?
Well, they had a few clues about one person, and his name was Jake Ferguson. And actually, he was the one who had done the very first ELF fire and had been involved in many, many of the major fires that had happened. And they essentially bluffed him. They pulled him in. They pulled him in for questioning and led him to believe that they had more evidence than they did, and offered him a plea deal, which he took.
He's a troubled guy in other ways as well. He's had problems with heroin.
Right.
And he's, as you say, he's the first person to really burn anything down, and yet he is the only one who's escaped going to jail.
Well, it is interesting. He agreed to wear a wire, and the government flew him around the country to record these conversations with his old friends, all of whom had stopped doing arson years before, and those recordings were kind of the first dominoes that began to fall.
Now, you could call this arson, but why was McGowan given a terrorism enhancement when he was sentenced?
Well, that's one of the big questions of the film, is how we define terrorism. And you know, from the government's perspective and the perspective of the arson victims, it becomes terrorism when people use fear and intimidation to try to force you to do something that is that you know you're allowed to do, cut timber or whatever. And you know,
did people die?
No, no one's ever been hurt in any of these fires.
And so this is a destruction of property.
It's destruction of property. And you know, the ELF folks see it as the Boston Tea Party, you know, symbolic to draw attention. But when you see the photos of these fires and you see footage of the fires and you talk to the people whose buildings were burned, they didn't know who had done it. And you know, the head of one of the timber companies describes getting an alarm system for his house because maybe they were going to burn his house down in the middle of the night. So there certainly was an element of fear that was a part of it.
Were all the co-defendants given terror enhancements?
No, they weren't. And to some extent, that was because there was a particular legal question that was being argued at the same time that the larger semantic argument was being argued in the media.
But because McGowan was given called a terrorist, is that why he wound up at the communication management, one of the communication management units, which have been called little Guantanamos?
Yeah, that is what the government has said is one of the reasons that he's there. So these prisons were set up after 9/11 to house terrorists, and so he doesn't have much access to the outside world. He's allowed a 15-minute phone call a week and a few-hour visit with his wife that happens through glass. So it's a very, very restrictive prison.
Well, when you say the word terrorist, it automatically puts an onus on you that's quite different than if you say arsonist.
Right.
Now, arson is a terrible crime, but terrorist evokes images of 9/11.
Right. Right. And I think particularly in New York, you know, Daniel's sister said we lived in through 9/11, and to use the same word to describe Al-Qaeda, to describe my brother, who clearly should go to prison for doing these fires, but that's an inappropriate use of the word, in her opinion.
When you spoke to the people whose property had been destroyed, did they like the use of the word terrorist?
They did feel like it was appropriate. They felt like they had been terrorized.
You've said in interviews that you hope that your film will raise more questions than it answers. What are some of the questions you would like to raise?
Well, I think questions about how we define terrorism. It's a term that is thrown around a lot, and I think when you start pressing people on the details, if anything, that you find out that actually we have kind of half-baked understandings of what it means. I also hope that it will be kind of a cautionary tale to activists to think carefully about the tactics that they're taking and what's effective, and a cautionary tale to the government to think about what reactions radicalize people.
I'm assuming that this film began when Daniel McGowan was arrested in your wife's office, and you didn't know a heck of a lot about this story.
That's right. I mean, the films that I've made before, one was about Cory Booker's first run for mayor of Newark. The other one was about kids who want to become NASCAR drivers. So it's not as if I've had this, you know, career of following environmental radicals. And so but for me, the most interesting experience in making documentaries is when I get to spend a couple of years finding out about things I don't know about.
Mm-hmm. And probably debating with yourself as to what the right approach to these things might be.
That's right. And debating in our edit room with, you know, we had a terrific editor, Matt Hamachek, and he and I spent a lot of time arguing.
Because you can skew it one way or the other. Really. Any documentary can be made into a piece of propaganda.
That's right. And this film has a point of view, but it's a complex point of view that I think reflects my honest belief that these are tricky questions. They're not simple questions.
So Daniel McGowan is in a CMU right now. How long will he be there?
His sentence is 7 years, and he's about halfway through. So it's unclear whether he'll spend the entire time in his CMU. The way that the Bureau of Prisons works is there's not a lot of clarity on why people are in there. There's not an appeal process, so it's unknown.
And does he share a space with people who we all might call terrorists?
Yes. Those are the folks who are in that wing with him.
So what happens? Have you talked to him about going and playing basketball with somebody who
Al-Qaeda
wanted to kill him?
And, yeah. I mean, I haven't talked to him myself because he has such limited access. But from what I hear through his wife and his sister, he's in there with very different types of people.
Have you been surprised by what happened to Cory Booker over the course of his political career?
I sure have.
Have you been watching?
In some ways,
Frick
surprised.
City?
In some ways, it was exactly what I might have expected. But so my film was Street Fight was about his very first run. So he was just a city councilman, kind of unknown at that point when he ran the first time. But it has been amazing to watch his meteoric rise.
Well, that documentary was really as much about Sharp James and how he was running Newark as it was about Cory Booker. And so the choice was obvious. Now the choice is a little less obvious to people in Newark.
Yeah, I mean,
maybe Newark is ungovernable.
Well, I don't know. I think there are. I think they've made some progress, and I monitor the some of the chat rooms, and there are some folks who, maybe don't love Cory personally, but begrudgingly give him credit for having made a lot of great changes there.
So where do you go from here? You wait until somebody else is arrested in the wife's office?
Let's hope it's no time soon. I've got a few ideas. But once we finish, the film will roll out to Seattle and L.A. and San Francisco. And after that, I'll dig into something new.
And this problem is still not resolved. We are still cutting down forests that perhaps should be spared.
I think that's right. Yeah, we have a lot of serious ecological issues that need some attention.
If a Tree Falls, a story of the Earth Liberation Front, directed by Marshall Curry and also by Sam Cullman. Mr. Curry has been my guest today. By the way, the film opens at the IFC Center today on 6th Avenue in Greenwich Village. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. I really appreciate having me.